Let's call this meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:30 p.m. and it is Friday, March 31st, 2023. Before we begin, I want to thank Joanna Crossett, the Senate Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Sydney Truitt from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. This time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Senator Kaufman, Senator Giesel, my Vice Chair, Senator Keel, and myself, Senator Klayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. Our first and only order of business today is Senate Bill 64, Controlled Substances, Homicide, Good Time Deduction, sponsored by the Senate Rules Committee by request of the Governor. This is the second hearing of the bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee. On teleconference today, speaking to the bill is John Skidmore, Deputy Director of Criminal Division, Department of Law. Here in the room as well is Kate Talmadge, aide to Deputy Director Skidmore. It's actually not Deputy Director. Oh, yeah, it is Deputy. That's right. Sorry. It's Deputy Attorney General Skidmore. Ms. Talmadge will provide a section of the bill. I would remind folks we had public testimony and invited testimony at the last hearing, and because we wanted to accommodate that testimony, didn't get the sectional, so that's why we have it now. Ms. Talmadge.
For the record, Katie Talmadge, aide to Deputy Attorney General John Skidmore with the Criminal Division of the State of Alaska Department of Law. Senate Bill 64 contains five sections. The bulk of the bill occurs on page 2, section 1, lines, and the relevant change on lines 20 through 25. Here, this makes it murder in the second degree, where an individual manufactures or delivers a controlled substance, and a person dies as the direct result of ingesting that controlled substance. Section 2 is the good time provision. It precludes good time deductions for individuals convicted of felony drug dealing. Section 3 is the repealer section. It repeals AS 1141-120A3. That's the provision of manslaughter that's being moved to murder in the second degree by Section 1. Section 4 is the applicability section. This bill is applied prospectively. Section 5 is the effective date. This act takes effect July 1st, 2023. And with that, Mr. Chairman, this concludes the sectional analysis, and Mr. Skidmore is available to answer any questions.
First, I'll see if there's questions about the sectional analysis. I don't see any on that. Questions for Mr. Skidmore? Senator Keel, are you pulling your microphone because you have questions? Okay.
Always tuned into the subtle clues. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the first question goes to, I believe Section 1 of the bill picks up this language directly out of manslaughter. I don't think it changes between in the move from manslaughter to murder in the second degree. The definition of delivers is I guess a question. What is the range of conduct covered by delivers in this statute?
Through the chair to Senator Keel. For the record, this is John Skidmore, the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division of the State of Alaska Department of Law. Delivers is a term that is used throughout the statutes in 1171, which are the drug statutes, and it's actually defined in 1171-900, subsection 7. Deliver or delivery means actual, constructive, or attempted transfer from one person to another of a controlled substance, whether or not there is an agency relationship between those two individuals.
Follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So certainly that would cover anything I would think of as importation or dealing. How would it apply to two individuals using drugs simultaneously? Would one of them, the one who brought the drugs, be delivering the drugs to the other?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, we would have have to be able to establish and prove beyond a reasonable doubt that one person was providing the drugs to the other and who that was. And while that would technically fall into this definition, I don't think I've ever seen a prosecution where someone's simply handing the drugs to somebody else. The delivery and the way that the Department of Law has approached that over the years is for the individuals that are selling it to somebody else. But I want to be clear, the definition of delivery is broader than that. The definition of delivery, as it currently exists in statute, does criminalize handing the drugs from one person to another person.
Follow-up?
Slightly different topic today.
Nobody else has their hand.
I just didn't want to jump in front of anybody.
I think you got the mic. You can just roll with questions.
Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to be nice. Mr. Skidmore, I appreciate those insights. You talked about the historical practice. I guess, can you provide, if you have the data, some insights on the use of this provision, which is now in manslaughter, but how often do we prosecute, have we prosecuted, I guess, charged and prosecuted under this causing a death language that would be picked up and moved from one level of severity to the next?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I appreciate that question. The answer is it is not used very frequently, and the reason for that is that it is very difficult to establish the elements of the crime itself. This particular subsection of manslaughter was enacted back in 2006. Though I don't have statistics going all the way back to 2006, I do have statistics since January 1st of 2018. So in that last 5 years, essentially what you have is that we've charged that particular subsection a total of 7 times. In those 7 times, in 2019, there were 4 people charged with the death of a 5th person. And I think this will be illustrative to what some of your questions may be. In that instance in 2019 where 4 people were charged, I'm going to refer to them as person A, B, C, and D for the ease of this. Person A sold drugs to person B. Person B then sold drugs to persons C and D. And C and D gave or shared those drugs with their friend, the 5th person, who died. All 4 of them were charged with this particular conduct. Ultimately, what happened in the cases is that C and D, the people who simply shared the drugs with their friend, agreed to cooperate and testify against person D, who had sold them the drugs. C and D were ultimately convicted of misconduct involving controlled substances in the 2nd degree and received a sentence of 4 years with 1.5 suspended and 1.5 to serve, 2.5 suspended and placed on probation for a period of 3 years. Person B, the one who sold the drugs to C and D, was ultimately convicted of that subsection of manslaughter and was sentenced to 7 years with 3.5 suspended and 3.5 years to serve and was placed on probation for 5 years. The charges against person A were dismissed because C and D could not establish that the drugs had been purchased from A, B would not cooperate in the prosecution against A, and there was insufficient evidence without that cooperation for person A to be convicted. In another case, in 2019, we had an individual who provided drugs to another person and ultimately killed that 2nd person. This particular fact pattern is a little different. He had not sold the drugs to the 2nd person, but the 2nd person had begun to OD, and the defendant was with the 2nd person who was ODing on those drugs, overdosing on the drugs, at the time the paramedics arrived. However, that individual had not taken advantage of several other opportunities to call for help earlier, had failed to do so. And indeed, that individual, the defendant in the case, had resisted calling authorities, instead opting for what I will describe as very risky and distasteful choices. And I apologize for some of the graphic nature of the description, but this is what happened. The individual who is ultimately charged attempts to revive their friend by first smoking methamphetamine and trying to blow that methamphetamine into the victim's mouth and lungs to revive them. When that failed to work, he transported the victim to a second location, stripped all of the clothes off the victim, and placed him into an ice-cold water bath, thinking that that would potentially revive his friend. When that failed, he finally resorted to taking a butter knife that had been placed in the freezer and inserting the butter knife into the other person's anus in a misguided attempt to try and reverse the overdose yet again. Only after all of these things had paramedics been called. And I would be remiss if I didn't also point out that in that instance, the individual took the victim's car and the victim's wallet to the drug dealers who had sold him the drugs rather than provide them to the authorities or to the victim's family. This person was ultimately convicted, and it goes to that concept you talk about of a friend providing drugs to another friend. And while we typically do not charge someone with distribution for that, these other extenuating circumstances caused us to nevertheless pursue that manslaughter charge for that other type of conduct associated and failing to actually get authorities there earlier. Those are some examples of cases in which we have tried it, but the answer to your question is it's been very few times in which it has been charged. Again, since January 1st of 2018, there are only a total of 7 charges and 4 of them related to that first incident that I described to you.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair to Ms. Skidmore. I notice there's no, at least with what I'm looking at right now, there's not really any parsing of substances. I think the assumption is that if it's capable of causing death, it's serious enough to be involved in the bill. Is that essentially the filter?
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman, that is accurate. And there are 2 rationales for it. The first is that we are finding one of the drugs that is resulting in significant increases in overdose deaths in the state is fentanyl. Fentanyl is found to be mixed with a whole host of other drugs, and that's one of the primary causes of overdose deaths, according to a report released by the Department of Health back in the middle, or excuse me, in the summer of 2022. However, the second drug, which is also playing a significant role in that, is methamphetamine. And so if you simply attempt to limit this to one particular drug, the problem is that would risk capturing those drugs that are resulting in the overdose deaths. And while we know those are the ones that were responsible in 2021 for the deaths, we also know that which of those drugs it can be changes. I would further note that that same report indicated that frequently when someone overdoses from drugs, they are overdosing from a combination of drugs. Between 2017 and 2021, heroin plus psychostimulants were the 2 most common lethal multi-drug combinations that were found in 18.6% of all drug overdose deaths. This was followed closely by synthetic narcotics plus psychostimulants, which resulted in another 18.4% of the deaths. Overall, it's important to note that the combination of drugs involved more than 58% of all of the drugs, all of the overdose deaths that occurred, and that in 34% overall of all of the deaths that occurred, there were 3 or more drugs. And so it's for that reason that we encompass all of the schedules there. That's the way the manslaughter statute was originally drafted, and that's why we leave it that same way when we elevate it to murder in the second degree.
Follow?
Yes, sir.
Senator Kaufman.
Different or related line of questioning. I notice on page 2, line 24, where it says in this paragraph, ingestion mean voluntarily. I assume that unless there's some legal reason that the word should be means voluntary, voluntarily, or involuntarily. So I think it's just a grammatical.
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman, I agree with you that mean. Should be means, ingestion means, an S would be an appropriate thing there. So, yes.
Thank you. I just happened to be staring at it. So, okay. Thank you very much.
So, in follow-up on the questions that Senator Keel had asked, I'm struck by the descriptions of the cases that you provided, including the case where you had, I think, five people involved and four got charged. And thinking about Ms. Snodgrass's invited testimony, which she, I think, to paraphrase her, was saying, I don't think the street-level dealer who sold to my son should be going to jail on murder too. He should be going to treatment, but the person who manufactured the drugs and was, in her view, more culpable should be going to jail for a long time. And it seems like what we've got here doesn't make that distinction that Ms. Snodgrass was talking about. Am I correct, Mr. Skidmore, or am I missing something about the way the bill is drafted?
Through the chair, I would tell you that I remember Ms. Snodgrass's testimony slightly differently. She was interested in the law not being applied to the friend that is sharing the drugs, but to the person who sold it. I don't recall that she had said manufacturing, but certainly if her statement on the record is different than I remember, then my memory would simply be faulty. But I believe she was saying she was interested in getting to the dealers, not the people that were simply sharing. And I agree with her that that is the goal of the bill, but as the first example that I described to you illustrates, frequently there are charges against people even who share them in aid of getting to the people who actually distributed them. And as the second example I shared also illustrates, that sometimes even if you are simply sharing, there is other conduct that I think many in society would say that person should nevertheless still be held accountable given that other type of conduct. Those are the sorts of discretionary calls that prosecutors have to make each and every day, and we continue to make with the law as it exists now and as we would continue to make with any changes that the legislature offers us.
We can both go back and listen to what Ms. Snodgrass said in her invited testimony, but let's just focus on the street-level dealer who's got their own drug addiction problems, not a friend, just a small-time dealer on the street. What's the justification if we take the view that that low-level dealer should not be treated as harshly as somebody more engaged in manufacture or larger-level distribution? Would you agree that this bill really makes no distinction between those two folks in the business of selling drugs?
To the chair, I would tell you that the elements of the crime, you are correct, don't make that distinction, but there are other elements of our laws, things that we refer to as aggravators, that though they are not controlling in a homicide case, there are aggravators that expressly talk about when someone gains a substantial pecuniary interest from the distribution of narcotics under 1171, that's really where an aggravator or a harsher sentence should be applied. And I would note that the sentence range for murder in the second degree is a minimum of 15 years, but a maximum of 99. And so while the bill itself and the language within the bill does not draw those distinctions, I do believe that our law allows for those distinctions to be drawn when it comes time for the court to assess what's the appropriate sentence or penalty to be imposed.
What's the minimum and maximum for manslaughter under the current law?
Manslaughter is a Class A felony, and it does not have a mandatory minimum. It has a presumptive sentence, which means that was typically what the court would impose, but it could depart either up or below it based on aggravators or mitigators. A first-time sentence for manslaughter has a presumptive range of 4 to 7 and a maximum of 20 years.
So if we were of the view that somebody that was a street addicted street-level dealer should be more looking at a 4 to 7 year sentence, but somebody that was engaged in manufacturing should be looking at the 15-year sentence for murder in the second degree, is there an easy way to separate those two in this bill? Obviously not with the language you've drafted, but I mean, we're essentially saying if we pass this bill, we're taking that street-level dealer with their own addiction problems and bumping them up from a 4 to 7 year sentence to a minimum 15-year sentence. If as a policy matter we don't agree with that, how do we separate those two?
To the chair, if you are attempting to separate manufacturing from other delivery, then I suppose you would focus on the term manufacturing. I don't know if manufacturing in and of itself will get you to the place that I think you're describing, because manufacturing is just the very first link in this causal chain. And the delivery then happens through several other stages as it progresses. In other words, manufacturer would only apply if, for instance, the drugs originated in Mexico with one of the drug cartels. It would only be the cartel that could be subject to a murder two, but all of the other individuals engaged in the distribution would just be the delivery. To differentiate the levels of delivery, I'm afraid I don't have a clear and easy way to do that for you. One of the concepts that people have looked at in the past is trying to differentiate the quantity of the drug, but the challenge in separating levels of seriousness based on quantity is that fentanyl itself is extremely potent and powerful in very, very small doses. If you have a pen or a pencil and you look at the tip of it, that's typically the amount that could be a single use, or sometimes that amount can be what can cause someone's death. Whereas if you look at methamphetamine or if you look at some other drugs, that same quantity does not necessarily pose the same risk or level to an individual. So trying to differentiate in quantities, then you also get into issues of purity and what else it may be mixed with. All of that's to say it's very difficult to try and differentiate between those different levels of delivery. That's why Alaska law has chosen to approach it by using aggravators that talk about a substantial gain pecuniary-wise, money-wise. That's the approach that they've always typically taken for it. I'm afraid I don't have any other good suggestions for you about how to try and separate the different levels of delivery.
Thank you. And then turning to another topic, on page 3 of the bill, there's a proposal to basically take away any good time credit for any felony drug offense. And I can understand the reasons that might apply to the Control 4A controlled substances that might include fentanyl and why that might be. But what's the thinking about why every felony drug offense should lose good time options in prison?
I think the rationale behind that particular provision, Chair Klayman, was anyone that is engaging in the distribution of controlled substances that are in our state schedules runs a significant risk that you can have fentanyl or other things mixed within it and can cause the types of problems that we are seeing. The concept that people that are distributing drugs should have a stiffer penalty is, again, a response to the significant increase that we see in overdose deaths. However, I would also tell you that this particular provision is one that we recognize good time within the Department of Corrections. For those that don't understand the concept, we're talking about mandatory versus discretionary parole. Mandatory parole being literally everyone has their amount of time in jail reduced if they behave while they are in custody, hence it's called good time. And that is absolutely without question a significant tool that Department of Corrections would utilize in trying to manage behavior. It's not the only tool, but it is a significant tool. And because of that, and because, as you describe, it seems to be fairly far-reaching, this is a provision of the bill that I would say the administration is very open to conversations and discussions with members of the legislature in terms of what's the right policy call for this topic.
Senator Keel, did you have your hand up?
I do.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Too subtle this time. Mr. Skidmore, I don't have any real expertise. Let's be honest, I don't have any expertise at all when it comes to time accounting. Is it fair to assume that if someone is not eligible for good time, they are likely to spend less time on Department of Corrections supervision of some flavor or other when they are released from the prison itself? Is that a reasonable inference?
Through the chair to Senator Keel, I, like you, am not an expert in good time. However, I believe the proposition that you are stating, if someone is not eligible for good time, there will be a reduction in the amount of time that they are on supervision once they are released from incarceration, is generally an accurate statement. Whether it's mandatory parole or discretionary parole, either the person is serving that time while in custody or they are on parole under supervision after having been released. And it's sort of traded off one for the other. So if you don't get good time, you're in jail as opposed to being outside on supervision. So the short answer is yes, I think that is an accurate statement.
In response to that, in addition, on the phone is Sydney Wood, Department of Corrections, on the phone for questions, and Lisa Purinton, Criminal Records and Identification Chief, Department of Public Safety. I suspect this is more for Mr. Wood. Mr. Wood, can you provide a follow-up response? And let me put a little, as opposed to words, let me give you numbers. And if I've got the statutes about good time wrong, you can hopefully ignore that. Somebody's got a 30-year sentence. They're eligible for good time release after 10. They're eligible for mandatory release after 20 years in prison. Can you respond to Senator Keel's question about good time and also apply it to that hypothetical prisoner that has a 30-year sentence?
For the record, my name is Sydney Wood. I'm the Deputy Director of Institutions for DOC. And through the chair, can you repeat the question one more time, just to make sure I got a 30-year sentence?
There's two parts. I think Senator Keel's question is, does the person who is released, gets out on a good time parole release, are they actually subject to longer supervision in the community because they are eligible for good time than a person who is only released on a mandatory release and has no good time eligibility? That's the question Senator Keel raised. I gave the hypothetical that you've got a person with a 30-year sentence. They're eligible for good time release after 10 years. Their mandatory release for parole, assuming they have no deductions, is at 20 years. And that was a context in which to potentially answer Senator Keel's question.
Okay, thank you for the question. Through the chair, first, there's a little bit of a discrepancy in terms of, I believe what you mean by good time release is discretionary release.
That's correct.
So for using that situation, if there is no good time, the person could not be released at the 20-year mark for the remaining 10 years of super, they would be released to mandatory parole for the last 10 years of their sentence. If they were released at any point before that two-thirds mark or the 20-year mark on a discretionary release, the good time would have no impact on that supervision length. They would be in the community as long as they complied with the conditions of their parole. They could serve all of the remaining time till their maximum release date. I do agree with what Director Skidmore said. It is an accurate statement that reducing or taking away the good time means they'll spend that time in prison versus out on supervision. If they had, if mandatory parole was part of their sentence or part of the result of their sentence, any time that no good time exists, then the only supervision that's going to follow their release would be probation, And if they flat time their sentence, then there would be zero supervision once they're released. I'll take it one more nuance to this. Why don't you pause for a minute?
I think Senator Keel has a follow-up. I think you're getting, when you're getting into probation, you're kind of getting off the topic here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think, just for the policy level question, I don't need quite as much detail as Mr. Wood is able to provide. It runs the risk of confusing. But I guess the policy level question then is, it comes in two pieces. One is that good time is often considered to be an important element of managing offenders inside an institution, encouraging better behavior, discouraging bad behavior. But the other is the opportunity to reintegrate folks into the community. I'm not so much thinking about folks with 30 years, but some of the folks with some of these lesser sentences for felony drug offenses covered by the bill. Why would less time supervised in the community be a desirable thing? To whomever with the administration would like to take that one.
Either Mr. Wood or Mr. Skidmore.
Through the chair, this is Sid Wood again. I would just say I can't answer the question as whether it's desirable or not. I will say that the Department of Corrections does have two community placement programs that do not rely on good time to qualify. One is sentence electronic monitoring, and they're eligible for that within the last 3 years of their sentence, as long as DV is not a part of their crime. And furlough is the other program, and that's also within the last 1/3 or 3 years of their sentence. And so those are options for community reintegration. So that's all I had.
And this is John Skidmore through the chair to Senator Keel. I agree with you that an opportunity for someone to reintegrate into the community is an important component. And I think you've heard Mr. Wood describe a couple of other options for how that can occur. There is discretionary parole, there's mandatory parole, and then there is probation. And all three of those also provide those opportunities. So when you add that to the two that Mr. Wood just described, you have five different ways in which that can occur. What the bill does is it limits one of them, but leaves the other four potentially in place. Nevertheless, your underlying premise of is reintegration in the community important and do we want to have that opportunity? And the answer to that is yes.
So, and going back to my 30-year hypothetical, and I sometimes choose hypotheticals for ease of the math, especially for somebody of my limited math skills. But in that hypothetical, the prisoner that is eligible for discretionary parole, or what we would call a good time release, we have the potential to supervise that person in the community if they're eligible for good time and for discretionary parole. In that hypothetical, we have the ability to supervise them for 20 years in the community at a substantially lower cost than keep them in prison. Whereas if we take away the good time option, we're essentially saying, we're going to have them in prison for the 20 years and then only supervise them for 10. And to the extent that we're interested in providing that in-community rehab opportunity and also close supervision of potentially people we consider dangerous, if we think they can be placed in the community safely, aren't we actually taking away meaningful opportunities for supervision by taking away the good time or the discretionary parole option?
To the chair, yes, the bill does take away some opportunity. However, I would be remiss if I didn't point out there were five different options of how you can get that supervision. This bill takes away one of those but leaves the other four. Doesn't change the fact that it's limiting it, but there are still four other opportunities for them.
And Mr. Skidmore, would you also agree that specifically, if you want to look at the probation question, probation only comes into play once they're released from prison. If you by this bill are taking away the period of discretionary parole, for my 30-year example, or it could be a 3-year example with eligibility after 1 year, but under either scenarios, you don't even get into the probation analysis until you've finished your mandatory term of prison.
I agree with that, Chair Clayman. That's absolutely correct.
Senator Giesel, do you have a question?
I have a question, perhaps, or perhaps it's a comment. So what we're talking about here is folks that are manufacturing and delivering pretty serious, very serious, not just pretty serious, but very serious drugs. And I look at the Alaska Controlled Substance Schedule that has been provided in our supporting documents. And I'm thinking about these actual people, and I'm thinking about the stories that Deputy Commissioner, or I'm not sure exactly what Mr. Skidmore is, he's somehow very high up. In any case, he described some cases to us. Now, the folks that are committing these crimes of manufacturing delivery are often addicts themselves to some degree. And knowing what I know about addiction, the longer they're in a controlled environment, the more likely they are to get some degree of treatment for their own problem. And so I actually don't have a problem, a concern, a negative feeling about this idea that they would not be eligible for good time deduction. The longer they're in a controlled environment, the higher the chance that they are, air quotes, clean longer. I realize drugs get into prisons. But these folks are dealing with some pretty serious drugs here as I look at the Alaska Controlled Substance Schedule. So I think that's something that needs to be taken into account here. They're not only killing other people with these drugs, but they themselves have these problems. I don't think there's a question in there, but it's my observation. I'm not a lawyer.
But you're a member of this commitment, so you get the equal treatment.
So you're stuck with me.
No,
yes.
You get equal treatment.
Right, yeah.
We're not stuck with you. And I agree that that's a comment and not a question. Other questions, Senator Keith?
Mr. Chairman, I will make a comment of my own. Unfortunately, the majority of our prison treatment programs are at the end of your time, not the beginning. Residential substance abuse treatment, for instance. Certainly, Narcotics Anonymous is available throughout, but the significant treatment programs really come prior to release, either directly to the community or more often to supervision. And the reason that I was trying to wrap my head around the impacts of this is that there have been two Alaska reports or recommendations in the last 6 months. The Governor's Council on Opioid Remediation and the Alaska Opioid Response Plan by the Health Department of Health. I don't think it's plan. I have the title wrong. And they both talk about the need to increase the work we do with folks on supervision after their criminal sentences. And they have slightly different approaches to that, but basically more treatment, help them get jobs, supervision, you know, making sure they're staying clean. And neither calls for enhanced sentences or more time in. And so I'm sort of looking at the things that this administration has put out in the last 6 months and trying to square them with the bill.
Another comment, not a question.
Yes.
Senator Kaufman, any comments or questions? All right, I don't have any additional comments or questions. At this time, we will hold the bill for further review. I thank you all for your time, Mr. Skidmore, Mr. Wood. We will adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is Monday, April 3rd at 1:30 p.m. We stand adjourned. The time is now 2:10 p.m.